four more times as his duplicate repositioned himself and again raised the rifle. Something splashed into Fowler's eyes, blinding him. Burning agony in his shoulder came a heartbeat later, and Fowler realized it was blood in his eyes. Gasping in pain, he wiped his eyes with his good arm. His duplicate was struggling to get into position to fire again, his eyes trained on Fowler so intently he didn't notice Storm below him, closing fast. She was falling face up, her arms and legs spread. When she'd closed to within just a few dozen feet, she raised her gun and fired. Storm didn't stop firing until she plowed right into him. By that time, he was dead, his blood spraying upward in sheets. Careful to avoid the swinging tail of the pilotless Harrier, they headed toward Snakebite, who was limp, his arms flapping in the wind. Fowler wrapped his arms around Snakebite from behind. When he saw Snakebite's eyes, open, sightless, Fowler pressed his face into Snakebite's back and screamed. He cried on his friend's big shoulder. Fingers touched the back of Fowler's neck. He lifted his head and, ignoring the pain in his shoulder, reached out to wrap one arm around Storm, who was clinging to the seatbelt holding Snakebite to the Harrier. "He's gone," Fowler said. Storm pressed her face close to Fowler's as they clung to Snakebite. "I just want to keep falling," Fowler said. "I don't want to land anymore." Storm nodded. She lifted her head, stared at Fowler's shoulder, her red-rimmed eyes widening. "Is that your blood? Are you shot?" She looked around. Melissa and Penny were nowhere in sight. "We have to get you help. We have to stop the bleeding." She reached up to where the seatbelt was tied to the Harrier, tried to pry it loose. "His left leg," Fowler said. "There's a knife." Storm strained, pulled up Snakebite's pant leg, unsheathed the hunting knife, and cut the seatbelt. With Snakebite between them, they pushed off the nose of the Harrier and got clear of it. "Fowler?" Storm's cry seemed to come from far off. He opened his eyes, realized he'd blacked out. He grasped the webbing of Snakebite's suit with his good arm, pulled himself closer. "We have to let him go," Storm said. "Unzip his pack," Fowler said. He had his bad arm tucked close to his body. Storm unzipped Snakebite's pack a few inches. Wrapping his legs around Snakebite, Fowler felt around inside the pack until his fingers brushed the photos, tucked in an inner pocket. Fowler slid them into his own pocket, against the photo of him and Melissa. "I'll find them," he choked up, felt his tears whipped from his eyes before they could reach his cheeks. "I promise I will. And when I do, I'll keep them safe, like they were my own." "We both will," Storm said. They unstrapped Snakebite's backpack, then let him go. Chapter 22. "Dr. Sandoval?" Paula Tankersley, his head of security, stood under the archway between the factory floor and the main passageway. "You have a visitor. We've detained him outside." "Who is it?" Peter asked. "He wouldn't say. Big guy, early 40s, accent." Peter found Ugo standing just outside the door to the lab, facing away, hands in his pockets, straddled by two security people. His Panama hat was gone, replaced by a snappy maroon U.S. Army beret to go along with a black and army green dress uniform. Ugo turned when the outer door opened. "There's a face I never expected to see again," Peter said. "This isn't a social call. With so many lives at stake, we can't always choose who we speak to." "I can't argue with that." Peter's thoughts were spinning, trying to anticipate what Ugo could want. Certainly, it had to do with their plea for a ceasefire. They were responding quickly. The interview had aired on MSNBC 2 hours earlier. "Shall we walk?" Peter shrugged. "I could use some air." He turned to Paula. "We're fine."
"Impressive setup," Ugo said, nodding slowly, hands behind his back as they walked. "You've got your own little army.
And you've got a big one."
Ugo laughed. "I'm part of a big one. The people in charge sent me. They caught your TV appearance."
"And?"
Ugo held out his hands, looked toward the sky. "Unlimited energy forever? Come on, Peter. Or should I call you Peter the Second? That's quite a claim."
They wanted to know what it was. They were dying to know. Of course they were. "We can back up our claim in 10 days. if the rest of you can keep from destroying the planet for that long.
No one's going to destroy the planet.
Peter slowed, studied Ugo's crooked profile. He knew that smug tone well.
Why is that?
Ugo tilted his head, lifted one shoulder toward his ear.
You have your secrets. I have mine.
To their right, a huge smokestack rose out of the yellow weeds. Beyond it, three rusting tanker cars sat on a dead-end strip of railroad track.
Only your secret's not so secret, Peter said. Right now it's ravaging Singapore and Indonesia. Ravaging.
Ugo waved a dismissive hand.
No one's dying. They're not even getting sniffles or sore throats.
It's wiping their memories.
Ugo glanced at Peter. Tough to fight when you can't remember who you're fighting or why.
Peter stopped walking. After taking a few more paces, Ugo stopped as well.
Singapore is an ally. You can't use the virus because it's too difficult to control. If you released it on Russia, South America, and North Korea, 80% of our own people would end up contracting it.
Ugo smiled.
That would end the war, though.
Peter laughed dryly. Ugo wasn't laughing. He was looking at Peter, eyebrows raised.
Wait. You're not seriously considering releasing that virus on a large scale.
He gaped at Peter as if Peter were being incredibly dense.
Why wouldn't we be? If the war goes on much longer, someone is going to start launching nuclear weapons. Maybe North Korea, maybe India. China would be my dark horse pick. As soon as someone goes down that path, there's going to be retaliation. And many will die then.
His eyes were wide, the vein on his forehead bulging.
How many more will die when the radiation drifts to neighboring countries? The blackout virus stops it now.
Ugo chopped his palm for emphasis.
What if the virus is too efficient? What if it wipes everyone's memory?
Ugo shook his head.
Central Command will wait out the infection in an airtight underground facility.
I take it you're part of Central Command. Ugo didn't respond. They were planning to wipe everyone's memory, ally and enemy alike, intentionally. Out of nowhere, Peter had a flash of memory. He and Ugo sprawled on couches in Ugo's living room, watching The Usual Suspects, drunk on Ugo's cognac, stuffed with pizza delivered from Cianello's. How had they possibly gotten from that moment to this?
Give me 10 days. Then all parties can sit down and negotiate a permanent armistice.
He wished Melissa and Kathleen were here to help reason with Ugo.
Where is this boundless energy?
He made a show of squinting and peering toward the lab.
In there? What are we going to do, put a chorus line of salmon through your duplicator and run the world on fish oil?
It was possible Ugo was bluffing, trying to force Peter to show his hand. The thing was, Ugo didn't sound like he was bluffing. He sounded like he was convinced his plan was better than the alternative. Removing the singularity from the equation, he might even be right.
Come on, Peter said.
The look on Ugo's face as Peter led him to the window on the containment chamber was gratifying. His smugness, his air of importance, melted away and left a little boy staring open-mouthed at a miracle.
What is that? He said, once he'd regained some of his composure.
It's exactly what it looks like. A singularity. Peter spread his hands, mocking the gesture Ugo had made outside.
Boundless, unlimited energy. Right here, in my lab.
Peter couldn't remember the last time he'd enjoyed a moment this much. Ugo had been so proud of his little virus. I'm on the verge of transporting energy to nanostructured carbon fuel cells all over the world. The energy will just keep flowing. The fuel cells will be inexhaustible.
Ugo went on staring into the chamber. Where did the singularity come from?
Peter laughed. Trade secret. His nose almost pressed to the glass, Ugo grunted.
Can you get Elba to agree to the ceasefire? Peter asked. Now, why would I do that?
Ugo stepped away from the glass and folded his arms across his chest.
so you can close your eyes and poke at some buttons and hope this singularity responds the way you're hoping it will?"
Harry was crossing the floor to join them. Peter waved for him to stay away.
"This is the equivalent of how many nuclear warheads?" Ugo asked. "A thousand? A million? And you're screwing around with it, lighting light bulbs?"
He gestured at the wall of spotlights.
"You don't need 10 days. You need 10 years of careful, controlled experimentation."
Ugo spun, headed for the exit.
"And you don't have 10 years. So if I can help it, you're not going to get 10 minutes.
"Oh, I see. That's how you're going to rationalize it to yourself. I have a solution that doesn't involve you becoming a god, one of the supreme rulers of the lobotomized masses." Peter took a few steps toward Ugo's swiftly retreating form.
"You're a sociopath, but your planning is no different from genocide."
Ugo stopped, spun, pointed at Peter.
"What you're planning is genocide. You're a loose cannon. You always have been."
He disappeared through the doorway. Peter called Kathleen, asked her to return to the lab immediately. They were out of time. Chapter 42. Someone was slapping his cheek.
"Fowler, wake up, you have to drink."
Fowler peeled one eye open as the canteen was pressed to his lips. He took a few swallows, pushed the canteen away.
"How long have we been falling?"
He'd been drifting in and out of consciousness for what felt like a long time.
"3 days."
His shoulder was bandaged with white strips, from Melissa's dress, he assumed. The strips were mottled with dried blood, none of it fresh as far as he could tell. His shoulder was aching worse than the day before, and he felt so exhausted his eyes kept closing on their own. Melissa and Penny were nearby. When they saw he was conscious, they came over. Melissa unwrapped the bandage.
"I don't feel well," Fowler said.
"The wound is infected. The bullet is still in there," Melissa said. Fowler spotted a lone figure falling through the clear blue sky a few hundred yards away. Snakebite.
"Am I going to die?" he asked.
The wind tore the softly spoken word away before it reached Fowler, but he could read Melissa's lips.
"There,"
Storm said, pointing straight down. Fowler closed his eyes. He didn't have the strength to look, but he knew what she'd found. He didn't care. Cries of disappointment cut through the howl of the wind. He pried one eye open, gently rolled on the wind until he could see what was below. The world was nothing but sand and rock. "We must have drifted over what's left of the Atlantic Ocean," Melissa said.
"We have to land," Storm said. "Fowler can't keep going."
Storm deployed Fowler's parachute for him. Snakebite plummeted past, down, into the endless sky. Fowler kept his gaze on Storm, tried to muster the strength to tell her he loved her. Storm pressed the back of her hand to his forehead.
"He's burning up."
Penny tapped Storm on the shoulder.
"Get out of the way."
Startled, Storm looked up at her.
"What? I said get out of the way."
Penny tugged her baggy pants down to her knees, exposing white panties and what looked to be a rough brown bandage wrapped around one thigh, only the bandage was bulky, bulging in places.
"What is that?"
Storm asked.
"It's a fucking medical kit," Penny said. "And you don't deserve it, goddammit."
She shouted this at Fowler. Fowler couldn't understand why Penny was angry at him. She peeled a strip of Velcro from around the kit and unrolled it beside Fowler. Melissa knelt, slid a vial out of a pouch and examined the label.
"Give me that."
Penny plucked the vial out of Melissa's hand.
"Morphine? Jesus, do you have antibiotics?"
Melissa asked.
"Why didn't you tell us you had this?"
Fowler watched as Penny straightened his bent arm and injected something into the crook of his elbow with a remarkably bright, tiny syringe. Then she pulled something thin and silver from the pouch.
"A scalpel?" Melissa said.
Penny paused to give Melissa a look.
"Would you prefer I leave the bullet in?"
She turned her attention back to Fowler.
"I gave him a dose of morphine, but I don't have anything to knock him out completely, so you two will have to hold him still. This will hurt even with the morphine."
She gave Fowler a cold look.
I'm tempted to make it hurt more than it needs to. How the hell do you know how to get a bullet out of someone? Storm asked.
Penny drew another vial from her pouch, shook red liquid into her palm, and rubbed it all over her hands.
I'm a doctor, a psychiatrist. I don't have much surgical training, but extracting a bullet isn't exactly brain surgery.
You did recognize me.
Fowler's tongue felt slow and thick. The medicine she'd injected into his elbow was sending a warm flush through his body, right down to his toes.
That's why you fell off your bike.
Oh, I recognize you, all right.
She tossed the bandages aside, picked up the scalpel, looked at Storm and Melissa.
Hold him down.
Fowler's eyes flew wide as fresh pain cut through the warm haze of the drug. The urge to pull away was almost irresistible. He squeezed his eyes shut, ground his teeth, and tried to hold still. It took only a few minutes, but it seemed like an eternity. While Penny was packing the wound, Fowler fell asleep. This ends Disc 8. Fowler, Disc 9. Chapter 43. Shouts woke him. It was pouring. Storm, Melissa, and Penny were shouting, encouraging the rain to keep falling. Fowler was afraid to move. He felt as if he'd been beaten by a mob with pipes, dragged up and down a flight of steps, then stomped with combat boots. It occurred to him that he should open his mouth, catch some of the rain. Penny interrupted the celebration. He's awake. Storm appeared with a canteen. She bent, poured water into his mouth, which absorbed right into his lips and cheeks, none of it reaching his throat. The next dollop allowed him to swallow. Penny watched, hovering in the background. She had a medical kit. Even more astonishing, she'd known how to use it. She'd also been furious at Fowler for no apparent reason.
What happened?
Everyone was blurry because the rain was in his eyes. He felt too weak to raise his arm to clear them.
Penny is a spy.
Melissa pushed her soaking wet hair away from her face.
I'm not a spy, Penny said. I'm a psychiatrist. I was doing research, monitoring the effects of the blackout virus.
The effects? Melissa took a step toward Penny, as if she were going to take a swing at her.
The effects are 1 billion people dead. I didn't release the fucking virus, Penny shot back, so get out of my face.
And the blackout virus wasn't responsible for most of those deaths. Peter's little black hole had something to do with it as well. That diffused some of Melissa's anger. We wouldn't have had to rush to deploy the singularity if that asshole Ugo hadn't been about to lobotomize the world's population. How did you avoid infection, by the way?
Peter's what?
Fowler gasped.
I thought you said I was Peter.
He was so confused. Penny was a spy? Penny pointed at him.
Yes, you're Peter.
There was no mistaking the heat in her eyes.
How am I supposed to hate you when you don't even remember what you did?
What I did? The rain eased, shifting from a torrent to a steady drizzle.
You want to find the person who did this?
Penny squatted, rifled through her pack. She held a small round mirror to Fowler's face.
There. There he is. Tell him what a son of a bitch he is.
You're out of your mind, Fowler croaked. He pushed the mirror away and looked at Melissa, who stared at the ground.
Melissa's been lying since you met her, Penny said. You did this. You're the greatest mass murderer in history, and you don't even know it.
You are so full of shit, Melissa said. I was there, right in the middle of it.
Oh, I know you were, Penny said.
Elba and her people are the murderers. Ugo is a murderer, not Peter.
I'm not a murderer.
He wanted to say more in his defense, but he was still so weak.
You're right, you're not, Penny said. Ugo Wolkoff turned you into an innocent.
She turned away.
That's why I couldn't sit back and watch you die.
Peter looked at Storm, who was squatting beside him, knowing she didn't have any answers. At least she was someone like him, someone from the world he knew, the world that had begun on day one. Storm reached out, stroked his good shoulder. The tenderness of the gesture brought a lump to his throat.
We were born on day one, Storm said, speaking softly. You, me, Snakebite. This has nothing to do with us.
Fowler wished he could believe that. He'd done this? He'd torn the entire world into pieces?
Him? Oh, and don't worry too much about Storm being a duplicate of Melissa, Penny said. You're a duplicate, too. You murdered the original Peter Sandoval and took his place.
He looked to Melissa.
Peter was dying. Ugo intentionally infected him with the disease, Melissa said. It was Peter's idea, not yours.
There was no way Fowler would ever understand this world he had lived in. He felt like he'd been hit with a brick. He, personally, had created a machine that ruined the entire world.
Is anything you told me true?
Melissa sat on the ground beside Storm. Her dress, which had been so clean and white when he'd first set eyes on her, was filthy and ragged at the knee where she'd torn strips to make bandages for him.
I didn't want to burden you with this. In your case, the blackout virus was a mercy.
That's for sure, Penny said.
Melissa shot her a warning glance.
The broad strokes of what I told you were true. I left out the part you played.
The broad strokes, Fowler repeated. He thought of the early days, after day one. He'd been a nobody, not even worth killing. If they'd known, he would have been the first one tossed over the edge.
Penny's the reason the assassins were able to locate us on her world and on the one we just left, Storm said. She's been communicating with them using a machine, a walkie-talkie.
They don't know where we are now, though, Penny said. They probably think we're dead.
Why didn't you tell them where we are, now that we have nowhere to hide? Fowler asked.
Penny looked at him like he was the dimmest of insects. When I told Ugo they'd taken your parachute, and you had no way to escape, I thought he was going to send more assassins. Instead, he tried out his shiny new toy, your singularity, and killed hundreds of innocent people. He thought it would kill me as well.
She looked from one of them to the next.
You're supposed to be the ruthless ones.
Evidently, he also killed the original me, so you shouldn't be too surprised, Fowler said.
Penny shook her head.
I've never heard that before. I'm not sure I believe it.
Melissa laughed bitterly.
Fine. Go on living in your hermetically sealed fantasy world.
She folded her arms.
You never explained how you avoided the blackout virus. How did you get chosen to be one of the lucky few?
My father worked in the Department of Defense, under General Holland.
Melissa sighed heavily, rolled her eyes.
Don't look at me like that. The rest of my family had their memories wiped. 3 brothers, my grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins. I got in because I had skills they needed.
She looked at Fowler.
2 of my brothers died before we could get to them, plus my grandparents and an uncle.
She looked around, spotted her medical kit, pulled out a small bottle, and fished a blue oval pill from it. She set it on her tongue.
Xanax. I've been sneaking them since this started. I was scheduled for pickup in 2 weeks.
Then why did you come with us? Fowler asked.
Because Peter Sandoval showed up, and they told me to stick close to him. Believe me, going down that slide was the bravest thing I've ever done. You have no idea.
You said a few thousand people weren't exposed to the virus.
Where are they? Melissa asked. Some are on the base world with Elba, a piece of Andrews Air Force Base near D.C. Others are with Wolkoff, at Peter's lab in Williamsburg. The rest are spread all over, trying to establish order on strategically important islands, or their intelligence gathering.
She shook her head.
For the most part, it's chaos. There's no power, no food.
Except now they have the singularity, Melissa said, and all the notes and recordings in Peter's lab to understand how to use it.
They'll establish themselves as the leaders of the world, make it over in their swinging dick image.
His notes, his lab. It was still hard for Fowler to grasp.
You came from Ugo's world? Storm asked Penny.
Penny nodded.
After the apocalypse, Ugo quietly shuttled people to some of the nearby islands for reconnaissance, and to keep an eye out for Peter, you, Harry Wong, the others who might know where the singularity was or how to make another.
With the other power sources gone, the singularity is more valuable than ever. Melissa looked for a relatively clean spot on her sleeve, used it to wipe rain off her face.
Now he has it, thanks to me.
Chapter 23. Peter and Harry
were waiting outside when Kathleen and Melissa barreled onto the lawn in Kathleen's Lexus, skidding to a stop half a dozen feet away. Talking with rapid-fire speed, Peter filled them in on Ugo's visit. When he got to the part about wiping the memories of everyone on Earth, save for a small cadre that would become the de facto rulers of the planet, Melissa cut him off.
No way. There is no way Ugo would be complicit in this. He was bluffing to get you to show him the singularity.
Melissa, he tried to kill me, Peter said. Or did kill me, depending on your...
This is different.
Not from where I sit, it isn't. Peter shot back. He pointed at his temple.
The man is a nut. A psychopath.
Harry held up his hands.
Come on, let's not argue. We have to decide what to do.
If they really are planning to release this blackout virus, knowing the singularity exists is going to accelerate their timetable, Kathleen said.
But they're military. They're going to have a strategy meeting before they act. We have a day, maybe two.
I'd need five of me to get everything done in a day, Peter said. Most of it only I or Harry can do.
Kathleen tapped her lip, thinking.
Then we'll make five of you.
It took Peter a second to understand what she meant. He held up both hands.
No way, Kathleen. I'm not going down that road.
Not just you, all of us, Kathleen said.
Down at her side, the index finger of her right hand looped and swirled, writing out the crucial words as she spoke them.
Come on, Kathleen, Harry said, but Kathleen ignored him. She touched Melissa's shoulder.
Melissa and I will sound the alarm on Elba's plan, try to stop it before it's implemented. Actually, we could use 100 of us for that.
She laughed delightedly at the thought.
Peter thought she sounded slightly deranged and wondered if the pressure was getting to her.
Kathleen, no, that's an insane idea. We're not duplicating ourselves.
Kathleen shoved Peter in the chest, hard, with both hands. Wake up! The world as we know it is about to end. We have to do everything we can to stop it. If that means jumping through the fucking duplicator, we jump through the fucking duplicator.
Peter looked to Melissa for help. Melissa took a deep breath. If you really think Ugo is going to do this, then I agree with Kathleen.
But I hope to God he's not playing you.
He's not.
Then let's go.
Melissa pointed toward the lab.
Wake up, Peter.
Someone was slapping his face. Peter groaned, lifted his hand to ward off the light but exceedingly annoying blows.
Peter, time to wake up.
It was Kathleen.
Not far away, Harry was saying, Peter, wake up!
Peter pried one eye open. Kathleen was leaning over him, her face very close.
There you are.
Everything came flying back to him. He opened his eyes wide, tried to shake off the grogginess of the anesthetic. Kathleen helped him sit up on the gurney. Peter looked around, noting that he was on the left, on the side where the original comes out, so he was the original, or at least the original duplicate, rather than a duplicate of the duplicate. It didn't matter, really, but somehow it felt important to know this. The other Peter stood, limped over woozily. He stuck out his hand. Peter shook it.
This is just too bizarre, the other Peter said. You want to head to the lab while I go through again? Seems only fair, since evidently I'm the copy.
That's okay, Peter said. You go ahead to the lab. He wanted to be there when his friends went through. Although again, it made no real difference that it was him and not his duplicate.
Wake up, Peter, Peter said as he slapped his fifth duplicate's face, while Kathleen tried to wake his fourth duplicate, who had gone through to produce the sixth.
His fifth duplicate opened his eyes, groaned, closed them again.
Come on, Peter, we don't have time.
Kathleen administered the injection of methohexital to another Kathleen as a third Kathleen waited to help lift her into the iris. The Kathleen giving the injection looked up at Peter.
You might as well get busy. I'm going to make a lot of me, send them off on various missions as they come out.
The Harrys and Melissas were already gone. Kathleen was right. There was no need for him to linger, save for a feeling that the duplicator was his baby and he should watch over it while it was being used.
Remember when I asked if you could turn DC into a crater, if you wanted?
The other Kathleen asked him.
Sure. It might come to that.
We have to power up the fuel cells first, but if it looks as if Elba and Ugo are going ahead with their memory wipe plan, We may be forced to take them out.
Peter looked out through the big window, at the lawn, the crumbling brick remains of the building across the way. Two security people, one of them Paula, were standing on the lawn with their arms folded, talking.
We've done some trials. I'm fairly sure I can use the singularity as a weapon if necessary.
She lifted the now unconscious Kathleen's legs, or the Kathleen who'd spoken first took her arms.
The problem is verifiability, Peter said. The blackout virus has something like a 24-hour incubation period. They could release it, and we wouldn't know for a full day.
He dragged his hand through his hair.
For all we know, they've already released it.
Outside, Paula sank to one knee. Her companion grasped her arm, said something. He lunged for his rifle just as the side of his face exploded.
Soldiers! Peter screamed. Everyone downstairs!
More of his security forces appeared. The tatter of automatic rifle fire erupted, muffled through the glass.
Downstairs!
Through the glass door, Peter spotted Melissa, one of the Melissas, anyway, in the lab's business office on the phone. He threw open the door.
Soldiers attacking! Downstairs!
Melissa dropped the phone and ran. They raced through the long hall, down the dimly lit stairs, through the locker room. Peter had no doubt these were Elba's troops, sent to seize the Singularity, probably with orders to take Peter alive. In all likelihood, they were elite troops, special forces. His security people had no chance against them. As they rounded a corner, three of his security people passed, running in the other direction.
Hang on, Peter called.
They paused. One of them, a small, stocky man, said,
We need to get up there.
No, Peter said.
They're special forces. Get on the radio and tell your people to get downstairs, below the level of the off-limits factory floor. It's very important they're below.
He continued toward the factory floor. Releasing a burst of energy into the air from the Singularity was simpler than directing it into fuel cells. It should take him no longer than 60 seconds to set it up.
Peter, what's going on?
Harry was heading toward them from the direction of the factory floor.
We're under attack, Peter shouted. Get everyone down in the sub-basement below the factory floor.
With Kathleen at his heels, Peter raced through the doorway onto the factory floor. He screamed,
Everyone downstairs!
The Peters and Harrys sprang into action, helping to corral the few who weren't duplicates down the stairwell, which was half blocked by rotting plaster and concrete from the partially collapsed roof. Peter turned to Kathleen.
Go on, I can do this myself.
She ignored him. Peter didn't have time to argue. He grabbed the laptop that was interfaced to the Singularity and set to work, creating the algorithm that would release several hundred joules of energy, enough to kill but hopefully not bring the building down on top of them.
Shouldn't we seal that big door? Kathleen asked.
No, I can't send energy through it, and they'll just blast it open, Peter said. Come on, press right up against the containment chamber. The faintest patter came from the hall. Peter typed frantically, stabbing the keys. Louder footfalls, someone running, breathless. A series of soft pops, like champagne corks loosed from bottles.
Harry burst into the room, stumbled toward them. Peter!
He landed face down, 10 feet from Peter. There were 3 bullet wounds in his back.
Harry! Peter screamed.
He and Kathleen dragged Harry close to the containment chamber as soldiers stormed in, automatic rifles raised, pressing close to the walls.
Hands on your head!
The soldier closest to the door shouted, his face shaded by the brim of his helmet. Tensing, expecting to hear more muffled gunshots any second, Peter reached out to the laptop sitting on the floor beside him and sent the algorithm to the Singularity. The soldiers exploded. There was no blinding flash, no indication of the energy coursing through the air, only soldiers bursting like water balloons, becoming nothing. Peter felt droplets of liquefied warrior strike his face and arms as he turned to Harry. Each of Harry's breaths brought a sharp squeal. He was bleeding from his mouth, his eyes unfocused.
Oh, Jesus, Harry, what did they do?
Peter lifted Harry's head and slid it into his lap, wondering if he was the real Harry or one of the duplicates. He hated himself for thinking that it mattered.
I'm okay, Harry said. Just need one of the doctors to take a look.
He was lying in a pool of blood. Peter could feel it seeping through his jeans. Kathleen was on the phone.
No one's answering. No one's answering 911.
It wasn't surprising, really. The U.S. government had just been overthrown. The sharp squeal of Harry's breathing went silent as they were carrying him up the steps to the lab and daylight. Chapter 44. When Fowler woke, he was falling. Storm was beside him, her hair tied in a tight bun to keep it from snapping in the wind. When she saw he was awake, she handed him a canteen. His hand trembling, he drained what little was in it, then turned away, chose a direction that was relatively private, and relieved himself. His urine, which was a dark yellow, whisked off into the air. Through practice, he'd grown adept at avoiding the spray. Storm angled in close when he finished. We've passed three worlds so far, all of them are barren. We're trying to glide back to where we were, but we don't know which direction that is. Fowler nodded. He didn't have any suggestions. If Melissa, who remembered everything, didn't know which way to go, he certainly didn't. Now that he'd had a chance to rest, he felt as if he had a better grasp of the situation. This man, Ugo Wolkoff, had murdered him, taken his and everyone else's past away, forced his hand in causing this apocalypse, as Penny called it, and stolen this thing he had created. The first way he made use of it was to tip a world, killing everyone on it. Then he'd killed Snakebite. That was why Peter had used his last lucid moments to draw that map. He was crying out to Fowler to get this singularity before Ugo and this General Elba did. Ugo was a lunatic. He'd turned the world into an awful place and seemed intent on making it even worse. If Fowler had been able to create this singularity, this thing that could upend worlds, surely he could figure out a way to get it back. Then he would learn how to use it to fix the damage he'd done. He took Storm's hand. Let's go talk to Penny. Hang on, Storm got her attention, waved her over. How can I get to him? He asked Penny. Hang on, Penny said. I may have saved your life, but if you think I'm going to help you, you're wrong. Ugo killed those people. He tried to kill you. Do you think he should be allowed to rule the worlds? And this thing he took, this singularity, couldn't we use it to help all of these people who don't know what's going on? It was difficult to speak loud enough to be heard, with the howling wind, and so little strength. You killed people too. You killed my brothers, my grandparents, so many people I can't even begin to list them. What makes you qualified to rule the world? Wait a minute, Storm said. Maybe Fowler was a bad guy back then, I don't know, but he isn't the same person now. You said that yourself. You can trust him. You know you can. Penny considered Storm's words. It's a moot point, anyway. Ugo has an army. His world has unlimited power now. Fowler would be doing Ugo a favor if he went there. If only he'd understood who Ugo Wolkoff was back on Snakebite's world. One way or another, this would have ended there. Can you get Wolkoff to come to us? Fowler asked. He came once before. Penny shook her head. He thought you were defenseless, and he was eager to find the singularity. Now he has it, and he knows you're armed and have allies. If I told him you were still alive and where you are, he might send another harrier full of assassins after you, but that's all. That was the last thing they needed. He allowed himself to drift away from Penny and Storm. He needed time alone in the sky to think. There didn't seem to be many good options. Run and hide seemed their best bet. If they knew the assassins were coming, they could set up an ambush. They had Snakebite's shotgun plus three handguns. But what good would that do? Wolkoff could make more assassins, as many as he wanted. It was remarkable how little difference there was between Fowler and these assassins. Penny said they were made from a Peter whose memory had been wiped by the virus as well. If not for what he had seen and done in the past few hundred days, and what they had seen and done, they would all be exactly alike, inside and out. Wait a minute, Fowler said aloud. Chapter 45. When Melissa called it a coral reef, his inner word supplier agreed. It was a jagged and twisty wall that formed an L shape on two sides of them. Lying in the crook of that L gave Fowler an uneasy, claustrophobic feel. It was the ideal place for an ambush, though. Penny swept her dark hair out of her face with a trembling hand. She was more anxious than he, if that was possible. Remember back on your world when those assassins had us pinned down in your apartment?
Yeah,
Penny said. Why didn't you just shoot me and run to them? Penny shook her head vigorously.
I couldn't shoot a dog, let alone a person. No matter how much I thought they deserved to die. Plus, I didn't have a gun.
What about the people we're about to kill?
Her eyes clouded. Don't make me have second thoughts about this. I'm still not sure which side I should be on.
Neither, probably.
I should just walk away, but I want to see it end, and you and Storm have me convinced this is our best chance of reaching that point.
Penny's walkie-talkie, a paper-thin steel rectangle, started flashing.
They're coming, Penny raised her hand, signaling to the others.
Fowler lay flat on his stomach and feigned unconsciousness. As far as the bad guys knew, he was in the late stages of something called sepsis, and Snakebutt and Melissa were dead. What seemed a hellishly long time later, Penny called, "Here!"
Fowler heard the thump of boots. He hoped the coral formations between Fowler and his attackers would shield him from their gunfire long enough for this to work.
Storm and Melissa opened fire. Fowler rose, pistol ready. Three Fowlers were charging, pistols flashing. Two others had stopped and were firing at Storm and Melissa. Three were already down. Fowler kept his head low, not allowing them a clear shot. He squeezed off shots at his duplicates, trying to remember what Snakebite had taught him during the rare peaceful moments they'd had, but all of his shots went wide or high or something. Part of the problem was he couldn't raise his left arm, so he had to shoot one-handed after using two in practice.
"Jesus, I don't like this," Penny cried out as she fired from a few feet away. "I don't like this."
Fowler tried aiming lower, fired again. A bloody hole materialized in the chest of one of the lookalikes, and he went down. Fowler let out an involuntary grunt of surprise, felt a stinging pain in his own chest. He'd killed someone. He wondered if it would have felt more or less terrible if the person didn't look like him. The final two duplicates were almost on top of them when Penny shot one in the face. His jaw exploded, leaving nothing below his upper teeth. Storm and Melissa appeared from behind cover on the far side of the Coral Canyon.
"Drop your fucking weapon," Melissa shouted.
The survivor's pistol dropped to the sand. Some of his comrades were writhing in pain on the moonscape, the rest were dead. Storm covered the sole survivor as Melissa approached one of the wounded who raised his hand.
"Wait, please."
Melissa shot him point blank. Her expression a tight mask, she strode to another wounded Fowler. Another shot rang out. Fowler wondered how she felt shooting duplicates of her ex-husband.
"I still think this is a terrible idea," Melissa said to Fowler as she joined them. "You have no idea what you're doing. Everyone in Ugo's stronghold is going to be armed. They have video surveillance, a fleet of harriers, tanks. You can't just waltz in there and take the singularity."
Fowler spread his arms wide, looked out at the darkening sky.
"I made it this far. Evidently, I'm a resourceful guy, and I have resourceful allies."
"I don't think you understand the extent of the damage you've suffered," Melissa said. "You're not capable of making an informed decision about this."
"We're disabled, you mean," Storm said.
"Handicapped. Those are the right words, aren't they?" Melissa stared at the sand.
"By definition, both of you have suffered severe brain damage."
"Based on that map I drew, I believed I could do this even before I suffered the brain damage," Fowler said. Melissa closed her eyes, as if trying to be patient.
"Listen to me. I remember what happened. I know what's possible and what's not. Let's take the Harrier and run."
"Run where?" Fowler asked. "You said yourself this guy has an army and unlimited power. Eventually his soldiers will take control of every world." The prisoner was looking from one of them to the other, trying to figure out what was going on.
"Penny," Melissa said, "tell them I'm right."
"She's probably right," Penny said. "We've got transportation now. We could run and hide."
"I don't want to run and hide. I'm sick of running and hiding."
Melissa walked off. Trying to quell his heart, which was still pounding from the ambush, Fowler struggled to his feet. He was still weak, still in pain despite Penny's painkillers. He hoped he'd feel better in a few days. He turned to Penny. "Ready to make the call?" Penny took a deep breath, nodded.
"Here goes."
She pulled out her walkie-talkie, moved a few paces away.
"He's dead. Sandoval is dead."
She listened for a moment, then laughed.
"I know, it's incredible."
A pause as she listened again.
"A wonderful day for humanity.
That's a great way to put it, Dr. Wolkoff.
Paula looked at the sky. He hated this man with an intensity he hadn't realized he was capable of.
Here's the thing, Penny said into the walkie-talkie. All of the Peters you sent are dead, except the one who got Sandoval. He suffered a gunshot wound to the shoulder. I treated him, but it's going to be a few days before he can fly the Harrier.
Pause.
I know, they put up a hell of a fight. They're all dead, yes.
After some additional discussion about how great it was that Fowler was dead, Penny signed off.
That should buy you 3 or 4 days, Penny said. Or it buys us a 3 or 4 day head start if we run.
I'm not running. He was done running from this bastard.
Chapter 24. Peter swept equipment off a long lab table, and they laid Harry's body on it. 3 members of their surviving security forces were outside, rifles leveled, sweeping the area.
Harry, oh God, Harry, Melissa cried out when she saw his body.
A moment later, another Melissa rushed into the lab and shouted pretty much the same words. Harry followed right after her. Looking stunned, dread-soaked, he approached his dead doppelganger, stopping well shy of the table.
This is too much. I don't think I can take this.
Peter wrapped an arm across his friend's shoulder, gently turned him away. Just a little more work to do, then we can rest. We'll have a movie marathon, eat popcorn till we're nauseous.
I'm nauseous now.
I know, me too.
He patted Harry's back. Peter clutched a table as 2 more Harrys spilled into the lab, along with 3 Peters, a Melissa, several Kathleens, all led by Paula wielding a rifle. The sight of them made him reel, made him feel as if he might drop through the floor or float away at any minute. He squeezed his eyes shut, took a deep breath. He needed to hold it together. One of the other Peters raised his hands to get people's attention.
We have to get back to work. Keep pushing, we're almost there.
That was all it took. People hurried away in different directions, others huddled to confer. Peter went to join 2 other Peters.
How close are we? He asked.
3 hours.
I hate to toss another complication into this, but I think we should move the singularity out of the lab. Hide it somewhere.
Peter was going to go on, explain that even after they powered the cells, Elba and Ugo might come after the singularity again, maybe using the blackout virus, but there was no need. He was effectively talking to himself.
I'll give you a hand, one of the other Peters said.
They hurried off to rig something to transport the singularity. They'd need a vacuum-sealed chamber and an electromagnetic field. Then they'd need to think of a hiding place. Out of the corner of his eye, Peter spotted 3 Kathleens at the duplicator, 2 of them prepping the 3rd for duplication.
Kathleen, Peter called. The 2 who were still conscious looked over. How many have you made? It's enough.
Just a few more.
One of them called back, her finger twirling in the air, air writing the words she'd just spoken.
Chapter 46.
The locals, 16 of them by Fowler's count, watched from the edge of the forest. They were getting bolder in their curiosity, maybe realizing that if the people who'd shown up in a functional Harrier meant them harm, they'd already be dead. Still, they kept their distance.
Into the wind, into the wind,
his lookalike, who insisted his name was 131, the number on his shirt, said,
watch your thrust vector.
Fowler had allowed his attention to drift, which wasn't a good idea, even if the Harrier did most of the work itself. 131 insisted it was still possible to crash the thing. The Harrier landed with a double thump. 131 nodded, satisfied.
It's still ugly, but it gets the job done. I think you're ready.
Fowler hopped down the steps, feeling self-satisfied. Although 131 had been stingy with praise, likely because he thought Fowler was the devil, Fowler thought he'd picked piloting up pretty quickly. 2 days, maybe 30 or 40 landings, and he was ready to solo, at least for the short one-way trip he was planning. He was still surprised how quickly 131 had agreed to teach him to fly the Harrier in exchange for his life. 131 had claimed it was because he disliked Ugo only slightly less than Fowler, and hoped they'd find a way to kill each other. Given that he and 131 were basically the same person, Fowler hoped that was the reason, not simple cowardice.
We're set, he says I'm ready,
Fuller announced to Storm and Melissa, who were waiting by the pond. Fuller looked to 131, who nodded. Melissa rose, pulled the pistol from her belt. Then let's get this over with and get going. Head down, she approached 131. 131 took a step backward. Hang on, what are you doing? I did everything you asked. Storm sprang to her feet. Wait a minute, what are you doing? Melissa kept walking. 131 glanced at Fowler, looked about to take off for the tree line. Hold on, Fowler said. Storm grabbed Melissa's wrist from behind, yanked her. Stop! What? Melissa said. You're not planning on shooting that man, are you? That is my plan, yes. No, you're not, Storm said. Let go of my arm, Melissa said. We had an agreement, 131 said. Fowler rested a hand on 131's shoulder. In a low voice, he said, It's okay. Penny, who must have slipped off to go to the bathroom, appeared from out of the bushes. She paused, took in the confrontation. Put the gun down, Storm said to Melissa. We're exactly one world up from Ugo's. If Ugo's people found him, he could tell them everything. Melissa yanked her wrist free. This is a war. Someone has to be the grown-up. As Melissa turned away, Storm whipped her arm around Melissa's throat, put her in a headlock. Drop the gun! Melissa grabbed Storm's wrist, tried to break free. Storm tightened her grip until Melissa gagged. Fowler considered intervening. If Storm had been the one in the headlock, he would have. But he thought maybe Melissa had this coming. Melissa dropped the pistol. Storm stepped on it, then released Melissa, who stumbled, clutching her throat. We're not shooting people just because we can, Storm said. I get it, we're fighting for our lives. Some lines you don't cross, even if you're fighting for your life. That sounds just like something I would have said before the war. Melissa was looking at Fowler, pain in her eyes. Oh, I've seen plenty of people die, Storm said. Evidently, not enough, Melissa shot back. Chapter 47. Fowler eyed the meager supply of food beside the Harrier. After that, they'd have to rely on foraging or trading with the locals.
I wish I could go with you, Storm said.
So do I, Fowler said. Actually, he didn't. This was likely to be a one-way trip. He didn't want anyone else to die, least of all Storm. Penny was holding a sketch she'd made on the back of a piece of paper she'd found in the Harrier. It was a map of Ugo's world. If you and Melissa do need to parachute in, there aren't many places you can drop without being noticed, even at night. There's a forested area over on this end that would be your best bet. She pointed it out on the map. Fowler, you're not going to be able to move around unnoticed after you take credit for killing Peter Sandoval, Penny went on. Sandoval duplicates are scum in this place, but you're going to be king of scum.
Sounds delightful. Maybe I won't have to leave.
Penny ignored the crack. Don't speak to anyone who doesn't speak to you first, not even me. Once you and I land, I'm going to treat you like a complete stranger. No offense.
Fair enough.
Chapter 25. With Iron Lives howling from the CD player, Peter sped up. He was doing close to 100 miles per hour, but there were no troopers lying in wait for speeders, so the only risk was an accident. His mind needed to be focused on the situation at hand, but he kept thinking about Harry. He didn't know how to grieve. He hadn't grieved much for his original self, either, because he hadn't felt gone, only moved. The same with Harry, although from the original Harry's perspective, he had in no uncertain terms been shot, suffered, and died. Lifting his hips, Peter pried his phone from his jeans pocket and dialed Harry's number.
Hey, Doc.
How you holding up? Peter asked, fighting the feeling that he was speaking to a stranger, an imposter. How ironic that he, of all people, should feel that way. Harry's duplicate took a big, huffing breath.
I'm hanging on by my fingernails. This is all so messed up. There are two other me's walking around, and I'm not really me. The real me is dead.
You can't think about it that way.
How can I not think about it that way? It's true. I'm not me. Me is dead.
You're you. It's just that there's more than one you. Now, try to focus on what you need to do.
That's what I'm doing. One of the Harrys is already gone in the Harrier with the original Melissa and Kathleen. So we're short-handed. Hey, you just walked by. You want to talk to yourself?
Even hanging by his fingernails, he was still a comedian. As he headed around a gentle curve, the George Washington Bridge came into view.
"I'll pass. I'm just getting into Manhattan. Tell me I said hi."
He disconnected, wondering if Melissa, Kathleen, and the Harry duplicate got out before the blackout virus hit, if Hugo had released it at all. Peter wondered if he got out in time. He'd know soon enough. The lanes leading out of the city were clogged, while Peter nearly had the incoming lanes to himself. Many were afraid New York was going to get hit again soon, although it was of little importance militarily. Maybe word was getting out that deposed President Aspen was hiding in Manhattan, and they were afraid General Elba was going to bomb it to finish her off. Peter wished Aspen had chosen a hiding place closer to his home. He hated being so far from his friends at this crucial moment. His phone buzzed, alerting him to an incoming text. The message read, "I sent you a box of chocolates." The sender was blocked. Oh, no. Oh, no, Peter dialed Harry.
"I just got a text from Hugo. He claims he released the blackout virus." "Shit, how wily, did he say?"
"No, at the very least, he's releasing it right at you. The message was personal, meant to let me know I was about to get it. Are you ready to go?"
"Just about," Harry said. "Minutes away."
"As soon as you do it, get everyone out. Cut everyone loose. Tell them to run and hide, far and wide. Hopefully some of you can avoid being captured if this doesn't work." If the blackout virus ran its course, and Ugo's group took complete control, Peter had no doubt Hugo would come after not just him, but Harry, and maybe Kathleen and Melissa as well.
"I have to go. I love you. Tell the other Harrys and Kathleens and Melissas I love them too."
Peter disconnected. He was flying down the Henry Hudson Parkway, the river on his right, no one shooting hoops in the parks he passed, no one walking a dog or rollerblading. Everyone was inside, watching the news, or fighting in California, or China, or Saudi Arabia. Or they were dead. He took the 39th Street exit. President Aspen was at UN headquarters on 42nd Street along the East River. Hopefully she'd managed to get a television crew inside to air the announcement that the energy supply was in place. Whether that announcement would restore Aspen to power, Peter didn't know. A wave of longing hit him unexpectedly for Melissa to be here with him. One of the Melissas, any of them. A billion stars exploded outside. Peter hit the brakes. Peter was alone in black space that wasn't space. It felt as if it were pushing in on him, suffocating him. He was seeing in every direction at once, surrounded by vast, twisting ladders comprised of ink-black spots. The ladders twisted in on themselves, shot off in straight lines to pinpoints. They filled the black, starless void like endless strands of DNA. His BMW thumped over the curb and onto the sidewalk. Peter braked to a stop just in time to avoid slamming into a building. Back in the direction of the river, people were shouting, screaming, really. Peter wanted to sit in his car on the sidewalk and try to make sense of what he'd just glimpsed, but it sounded like there were people who needed help. He got out and jogged in the direction of the screams. Singularities. Those billions of spots he'd glimpsed in that instant had been singularities, strung together in an elaborate fabric. Passing in and out of the long shadows of high-rises, he crossed 11th Avenue, spotted a crowd a block away on 12th, staring out toward the river. Only as he drew closer, the Hudson wasn't its usual dark gray-green. It was light blue, blending perfectly into the sky. It had to be an illusion, some strange reflection of the sky that camouflaged the water and the shore of New Jersey beyond. Peter slowed as he drew closer. The people seemed distraught beyond all reason, and the illusion of the powder blue sky existing where the Hudson should have been only grew stronger. A big, billowy cloud drifted serenely where Hoboken should have been. He reached the crowd, clumped together a dozen feet from the ragged edge of a seemingly endless drop that began halfway across what had been 12th Avenue. There was nothing beyond but sky. Peter kept walking, through the crowd, over broken chunks of 12th Avenue until he'd gone as far as he could without falling. He looked out at what he'd done. Then he turned and headed to the right along the drop-off, threading his way past thousands of sobbing, screaming, terrified people. Twice he stumbled and fell. Peter picked up a fist-sized chunk of concrete and hurled it over the edge. He watched it plummet, which was impossible because he was standing on a chunk of Manhattan that was not plummeting. By all rights, it should be plummeting. Chapter 48. Deafening music filled the cockpit, making it difficult to concentrate. Fuller needed to concentrate. His head ached trying to remember everything his doppelganger had taught him about flying. It would be a miracle if he was able to land the thing without raising suspicion or killing himself and Penny. When he was practicing, he'd been more relaxed, and there hadn't been loud, shitty music playing.
"Can you turn that off? It's terrible."
Penny killed the music. "Thank you."
"It's not terrible," Penny said. "It's terrible."
She folded her brightly tattooed arms.
"I happen to know Iron Lives was one of your favorite musical groups before your memory was wiped."
"Then I had terrible taste." Something smelled bad. He wondered if it was the bodies. Did corpses start to smell after only 3 days? Probably, if you were closed in with them, they did. "What else do you know about me? Apart from my being the biggest mass murderer in history."
"You were brilliant. You took a razor, sliced open the air, and pulled a god out through the wound."
How lyrical. "But I didn't know the god would do this when I set it loose." Penny shrugged.
"Melissa says you didn't. Wurkoff tells everyone you couldn't stand losing, so you unleashed the furies of hell on everyone, your friends as well as your enemies."
If that was true, he was a monster. Of course, all of Penny's information had been filtered through Ugo Wurkoff, who most definitely was a monster. He took out the walkie-talkie.
"What are you doing?"
Penny asked. "Calling Melissa. I want to understand why I unleashed the furies of hell. I need to practice using this anyway." Melissa answered immediately. "How did I end up wrecking the world? I want to understand." Melissa's voice grew uncharacteristically gentle.
"We were trying to stop a war before Ugo unleashed his blackout virus. You ran out of time and took your best shot. You're an arrogant asshole, but you're not a psychopath. Far from it. Ugo is the psychopath."
Peter laughed.
"I never thought I'd feel grateful to someone for calling me an arrogant asshole." "Well, you're welcome."
He envied and pitied Melissa for remembering all of this. "What did I do to make you hate me?"
She tisked. "I don't hate you. I'm angry at you. You are so impulsive. You are so impulsive. I guess it's hard to learn from your mistakes if you can't remember them.
We divorced before I made the big mistake. What did I do? Why did we split?" When she finally answered, her voice was thick with emotion.
"You lied to me."
Fuller nodded, then remembered Melissa couldn't see him. "I'm sorry I lied to you. Even if I don't know what I lied about."
"You didn't have much choice. It took me a long time to understand that."
They were getting close to their destination. "Can I speak to Storm?" Fuller didn't want Storm to think he'd called solely to speak to Melissa. He could hear Melissa choke up across all those miles. Her voice got very low, so low he could barely hear her words.
"Do you have any idea what it feels like for me to see the two of you together?"
Her words startled him.
"I don't, Melissa. I honestly don't." "Hold on. Melissa, wait. Hey!"
It was Storm. Fuller struggled to compose himself.
"I just wanted to hear your voice before I do this. It's so strange. I'm talking to you, but you're not here."
"I know. Meanwhile, I'm flying in a machine that actually works. I'm not sure if this is better or worse than the world we met in."
"Me neither.
The whole plan is probably going to fail. As Melissa points out, I'm a simpleton compared to them."
"You'll figure it out. If you don't, run and hide, and we'll come and get you."
Ugo's world hung 1,000 yards below, a mix of smallish buildings, roads, a few wooded areas.
"Well, I'll say goodbye now, because once that hatch opens, I can't speak to you again,"
Penny said. Fowler reached out, squeezed Penny's hand. Thank you. Penny handed him the Harrier's microphone set.
They'll expect you to call in before you land.
He used the voice responsive feature, as 131 had taught him. Hello? Fowler said into the mic. Who is this? An annoyed male voice snapped.
This is 131.
Fowler tensed, hoping his lookalike hadn't fed him false information about their referring to themselves by number, despite Fowler's promise that he'd come back and cut off his feet if he did. Well, here or not, since when is hello proper hailing protocol, 131?
I'm sorry. I'm not myself since the injury. I hit my head when I went down. I'm experiencing some disorientation and memory loss.
Step one of the plan was now implemented. Whenever he appeared ignorant, he would blame it on a head injury.
Don't worry about it. Given the circumstances, you could probably say anything and get away with it. Holy shit, 131, you got him. You left here a dupe nobody, but you're coming home a legend. Congratulations, man, congratulations.
Thanks.
He would have liked to use the guy's name, or number as the case may be, but hadn't thought to ask the real 131 what it was. Chapter 49. Fowler's knees felt like they might buckle as he carried the corpse dressed in his jumpsuit down the Harrier stairs onto an airport runway. Dried blood from the corpse's bullet wounds stained his tan assassin wear as hundreds of people applauded. But a third of them, packed close together and set apart from the others, looked just like him. Two men in overalls took the body from Fowler. A third confiscated Fowler's handgun and patted him down. Fowler recognized Ugo as soon as he stepped forward, grinning, dressed in a shiny uniform. They set the body in Ugo's arms. Clutching the bloodied corpse in one arm, Wolkoff raised his fist in the air. The applause grew deafening. He let the body roll to the tarmac, set his foot on its head as photographers circled. Fowler smiled tightly, straining to keep his burning hatred for this man from showing. Wolkoff motioned Penny closer. She faked a wide, jubilant smile as the photographers snapped pictures. Fowler stood a few steps away, not sure what to do.
Did he die immediately?
Wolkoff asked, raising his voice as the cameras flashed and the cheers rolled on. When Penny didn't reply, Fowler realized Wolkoff must be deigning to speak to him.
He was wounded. I ran up and shot him point blank to finish him off.
Wolkoff nodded.
Nice work. I'm sure your comrades will want to honor you with a private ceremony.
He raised his voice to the crowd.
The monster is dead.
As cheers rose again, Fowler couldn't help noticing how much pleasure Wolkoff derived from them. His expression was somewhere between that of a little boy being praised by his daddy and the smirk of a bully who's just pushed someone over the edge.
What should we do with the body?
An old man with a droopy mouth asked Wolkoff. Wolkoff nudged the body with the toe of his shiny black shoe, then knelt and examined Fowler's jumpsuit before grunting and standing.
Put it on ice. We'll take it on tour, display it island by island as we reclaim them.
That was all Fowler heard, as his lookalikes crowded around and led him away.
You got him, I can't believe it, one of them said.
I can't either. Fowler glanced at the number on the man's sleeve, 128. He needed to remember who was who.
It's not just Sandoval's face anymore, it's also the face of the dupe who killed Sandoval.
That's right,
Fowler tried to sound enthusiastic. They filed through a gate in the cyclone fence at one end of the runway, crossed a field, and headed down a shady street. A truck rolled past. Fowler willed himself to ignore it, as the rest of the Peters were doing. The town wasn't as clean as the clean parts of the orchid world, but it was cleaner than any other place Fowler had seen. More astonishing were the lights glowing inside buildings, the hum of machines coming from all around. They crossed a remarkably green, perfectly flat lawn that left flecks of moisture on his boots, then headed into one of many red brick buildings that formed a circle around the lawn. Down a flight of stairs, they filed into a huge gymnasium. Colored lines created geometric patterns on the polished wood floor.
It's been great associating with you, 131,
Peter 128 said. Poller opened his mouth to ask where 128 was going, but thought better of it. A hand rested on his shoulder. Poller turned to find a bare-torsoed Peter holding out his shirt. Poller accepted the shirt. It had the numeral 1 on the sleeve. "It's yours now," the shirtless Peter said solemnly. "Oh, okay. Thank you." The shirtless Peter waited. Poller pulled off the shirt he was wearing and donned the number 1. Every other Peter in the room pulled off his shirt. It was not exactly an impressive display. Each had the same 3 or 4 chest hairs, scrawny pecs, and bony shoulders. No one seemed to notice that they were all a bit thicker and better fed than Fowler. They exchanged them with each other. The previous wearer of shirt number 1 pulled on shirt number 2. Everyone was moving down a number to make room for him. "Come on," Peter 2 said now. "Let's get your things moved to your new room so you can get some sleep." He flagged down 3 Peters, all with numbers in the 130s and 40s, and told them to move Fowler's possessions from his old room to his new one. They sprinted away. The numbers weren't just to tell the Peters apart, like the patches the orchids wore in their world. They indicated status. Fowler was now Peter 1, king of the Peters, king of scum. It would be difficult to slip away, disappear over the edge without anyone noticing, if it came to that. On the other hand, maybe he could use his newfound status to his advantage. Maybe the other 150-odd Peters would do what he said. Or maybe he could use his status to get hold of another handgun. By the time they crossed the quad to another red brick building, this one divided into small, narrow dorm rooms, Fowler's room was ready. He thanked Peter too, pulled down the shade, and slept. A sharp knock woke him. His door swung open. "We're going to be late." It was Peter too, with others standing behind him. Fowler hopped out of bed, pulled on his shirt, and headed for the door. Peter too gave him a peculiar look. "Sorry, I didn't mean to suggest you didn't have time to brush your teeth." "Oh, right." Fowler headed for the bathroom and closed the door. He'd never brushed his teeth before, but he knew what a toothbrush looked like and had a vague idea what to do with it. Waiting outside with Peter too were Peters 4, 7, and 8. Fowler did his best to make it look as if he knew which way they were headed while following their lead. Walking in the center of the road, they crossed a bridge with a stream running under it, headed uphill, followed a brick sidewalk to the side entrance of a big 4-story building. The Peters led him into a semicircular classroom filled with built-in desks and chairs, a big screen at the front. They took seats in the front row as a stooped old woman fiddled with the technology at the front of the classroom. Before long, the woman began to speak, or, more specifically, teach. Everyone seemed to understand what she was saying. Fowler couldn't follow a word of it. "The velocity is L over T, plus or minus delta over T. What you're doing here is measuring the velocity accurately, but you're measuring it after..." Everyone was writing down the numbers. He tuned the woman out, tried to guess what was going on. Why were they teaching the Peters? Assuming these men had started out understanding as little of this as Fowler, they had been learning it for some time if they were able to follow what the teacher was saying.
"But you can think of it simply as a vector space with an infinite number of axes."
Fowler closed his eyes and mentally repeated this one phrase until he'd committed it to memory. Melissa might know what it was, although the plan was for Fowler to hold off contacting his comrades until he was ready to rendezvous to minimize his risk of being exposed. After class, Peter too suggested they go for a hike and get acquainted. It surprised Fowler that they wouldn't know each other pretty damned well by now, if they'd lived like this since day one, but he was happy to do something that would help him get oriented, maybe help him locate the closest edge. They almost collided as Peter too abruptly veered to his right. Fowler adjusted his step, spotted the opening of a narrow trail through the woods. A dozen paces later, the road was out of sight. The single digits are wondering if you'll be making changes to the strategy moving forward, Peter 2 said.
The strategy?
No, no major changes, he mumbled. Number 2 clasped him on the shoulder. I appreciate the vote of confidence. They crossed a shallow stream, single file, using three flat stones. While you were on your mission, 17 and his people have been lobbying hard for more aggressive action. He looked at Fowler. They say we should negotiate from a position of strength, which in their minds means refusing to obey orders until we get concessions. That's beyond risky. It's suicide. Fowler tried not to react. They weren't happy. Of course they weren't. How could a bunch of Peters be happy being treated like shit? This was wonderful news. A plan took shape in Fowler's mind. Peter 17 and his people were chomping at the bit for decisive action. Fowler would have to get to know them better. As Peter 1, maybe he could fan the anger burning in his brothers. Chapter 26.